What is HRV and why is it so important?
Could use heart rate variability to predict something called all-cause mortality. So death from anything. And in fact, it's a better predictor of cancer than it is of cardiovascular disease.
Dr. Alan Watkins, cardiologist, neuroscientist, author, TEDx speaker with over 8 million views, and someone that has spent decades studying the science of heart rate variability. Dr. Alan Watkins is also a huge proponent of coherence and has actually written a book of the same title. So in this podcast, we're going to go deep. Heart rate variability is very sexy right now. I was just featured one of the breathing exercises on this very channel on the Andrew Huberman podcast, probably the biggest scientific podcast in the world. So we're going to learn everything today.
There are 30 or 40 different ways of measuring heart rate variability, and they all tell you something slightly different. And sadly, a lot of the equipment manufacturers don't really care about any of that techie geeky stuff. They just have a measure and they pump out the data to you, and everybody buys the kit. And, you know, oh, my HRV is 27, and I go, 27 what? What emotional states do you even know? Yeah, make a list. Right, give you 5 minutes. Write down the emotions you've noticed in your system, in your life, in the last week. Just make a list. Mm-hmm. And people go, oh, I want to make a list. Right, you're going to go anger, frustrated, irritation, annoyed, disappointed. I said, how many do you think there are? So, do you know, Mike? Do you know how many emotions there are? There are 34,000. So if I plug myself to any biofeedback kit now, I have to work quite hard to get disordered breathing going in my system. You know, because coherent breathing is the default.
Today's podcast was made possible by you. By hitting the subscribe button, you allow me to get through doors that there's no way I would normally be able to get through to people like today's guest, Dr. Alan Watkins. But still over half the people watching your little sneaks haven't hit that subscribe button yet. So I've got one ask today. Please hit the button, please subscribe, and enjoy this fascinating conversation with Dr. Alan Watkins. I cannot wait for you to see it. Thank you so much. Here he is. I really want to start with heart rate variability if we can today, sir. And right. So I wonder if you could just explain for the audience, what is HRV and why is it so important?
It's been around in modern years since about 1965. And those people lucky enough, like yourself, I know you've got a new, relatively new baby, a year old. And my son had a baby on the 29th since the mid-60s in labor because... You know, one listens to the baby's heart rate in labor, and it was noticed that the heart rate was bobbling around a bit. And anyway, cut a long story short, it became known that if there was a loss of variability in labor, the baby was at risk. So since the mid-60s, it's been used to predict infant mortality in labor. Even to this day, they'll track baby's heart rate. And if the baby loses variability, then you've got to take a pH from the scalp, and if that's acidotic, emergency cesarean. That is the protocol to this day. And then in about 1975, there was an Australian physician who noticed, he was looking after people who had heart attacks, and he noticed there were certain patients who had variability, you know, their heart rate bounced between 72 beats per minute and 85 and 47 and 54 and back and forth. And then there were certain patients who almost had a metronomic heart, 72, 72, 72, 72. And those that lost variability after the heart attack never made it off the ward. They died. And so he wrote about this in the mid-70s, and that kicked off a big amount of interest amongst cardiologists about using heart rate variability to predict mortality after a heart attack. And then in 1995, another physician looked at the general population, and we discovered that actually you could use heart rate variability to predict something called all-cause mortality. So death from anything, including accidents, which is pretty interesting, which we can come to if you like. Mm. And in fact, it's a better predictor of cancer than it is of cardiovascular disease. So that was in 1995, HRV as a predictor of mortality. So there's a rich literature now. There's about 30,000-40,000 scientific papers in the literature initially using heart rate variability to predict the risk of death. So when we're teaching CEOs, I often tease them and say, look, actually, it's quite useful for you guys. You should be paying attention to this because it's useful for succession planning. You know, you know, somebody on your succession plan, he may not be here. So we could tell you whether that's going to be true or not. May all be, ha, ha, very funny. And that is true. You know, you can use it for that purpose. But it's not just mortality, Mike. It's also morbidity, i.e. illness. You can use HRB to predict the risk of getting ill. And in fact, with these 30, 40,000 papers in the literature now, there's tons of research, not just in terms of physical illness, but psychological illness and so on, you know, diabetic complications, all sorts of things. And because it's such easy data to acquire, particularly with the advent of the quantified self movement and, you know, various devices that we can wear on the wrist or the ear or the chest strap or all these things, gathering up all this data, it's such easy data to acquire. So from research purposes, it's almost perfect. Mm-hmm. You can acquire it very non-invasively, and then you can compare it to all sorts of things. So now a lot of people are very interested in its predictive power in terms of death and illness, but also recovery from illness. So through COVID, you know, who's likely to get COVID, who's likely to get long COVID, who's likely to recover quickly, all of these types of things. And people are doing this all the time. And then even looking more deeply is, you know, what other things can you extract? So it's a really interesting data set, a sort of window on human physiology. So the variance of your heart rate is really a sort of a general measure of your, you know, vitality, your health, because a complex system like the human body needs variance, like any complex system. So if you look at the example I often use is the Burj Khalifa in Dubai, right? When they built that tallest building in the world, they built it to sway in the wind a little, right? Because if they built it too rigid, first strong wind that comes along, it snaps because it's too rigid and too brittle. So an absence of variability is bad for the health. If the excessive variability, I mean, if it was swaying, you know, like, you know, 400 foot in either direction, everybody would be feeling sick in that building. And the same is true of a company. A company that is unable to vary when the market changes usually goes bankrupt. Or a company that's varying excessively, changing its strategy every 5 minutes, also goes. So it's kind of like HRV is an indicator of the health of the complex human system. And it gives you a window, not just cardiovascular health, but general health. And so that's why I think it's, booming in terms of HRV research is booming, and lots of people looking at it in lots of different ways. And we can dive a little bit more detail, yeah, more technical if you wish, but I think that's why it's on the boom.
That's a great overview. I would love to go a little bit deeper because you've just blown my mind a little bit here, because I always consider that from a lay point of view, there's low variability and good. But you've just spoke also about maybe there could be too much. And yes. And I'm just thinking about the weird comparison I've got is I was reading a book about free divers, and they were talking about like whale speak and how, like, even though you can hear these clicks as you zoom in, there's a lot more data. And so from your perspective or going deeper on HRV, What is it, just as binary as too little, good, too much, or is there something else going on? For example, you've got a good HRV at night, but a bad when you wake. How are people telling when you're going to die, where you might get cancer? Is it as simple as good, bad, too much, or is there more?
No, it's not. It's much more nuanced, fortunately, and that's what makes it so useful and so interesting. And I'm constantly trying to stop people seeing it in certain binary terms, because of course the human system is beautifully complex and subtle and so on, and it isn't a question of lots of HRV good, no HRV bad. I mean, it's generally speaking, it's an inverted U curve, so you want this optimal amount of heart rate variability. So as a general rule of thumb, lower amounts of HRV are not particularly good. And excessive HRV tends to be bad. So if you've got an arrhythmia, for example, either generated by the upper chambers, an atrial arrhythmia, or the lower chambers, much more dangerous, a ventricular arrhythmia, you will see a massive amount of variance, but that's an unstable system. So that's when you've got excessive HRV. But for most people, you want this sort of golden window, the right amount of variance, just like you do in a company, the right amount of adaptability of the system. So complex systems need variance. It's a sign of health. Mm-hmm. Not too much, not too little. Mm-hmm. And also, depending on how you measure HRV, and we can get into this, there are 30 or 40 different ways of measuring heart rate variability. And they all tell you something slightly different. And so you've got to be a real geek to understand how this stuff works. And sadly, a lot of the equipment manufacturers don't really care about any of that techie, geeky stuff. They just have a measure and they pump out the data to you and everybody buys the kit. And, you know, oh, my HRV is 27. And I go, 27 what? I don't know, but it's 27. Yeah, what, 27 bananas? What is it? And they don't really know. And the manufacturers don't even tell them. So, but it's 27 and it was only 26 yesterday. And that's a good thing, isn't it? Well, maybe, I don't know. Depends what's being measured. So I think the next phase of technology will... people will start to kind of wise up to, you actually do need to know what this stuff is, because, you know, there are different aspects of HRV, looking at different aspects. It's a little bit like saying you're taking your car to for an MOT and saying, you know, it's 27. What, 27 pounds per square inch in the tires, 27 miles to the gallon, 27 what? You know, and so people over time will start to realize that actually, depending on which parameter you're using, you can look at different aspects of your car or your physiology if you know what these different things are.
I'm sure you've been asked this question a lot, and we don't have to name the bad brands, but could you recommend for the audience at home watching and listening to this, if they wanted to start getting into HRV and starting to track it in this quantified self, where can they start? Hey, I hope you're enjoying Dr. Alan Watkins. I promised you it is a storm and there are so many cool things coming up. Just a very quick one from me. I am currently open for one-to-one coaching. So let 2024 be your year. You're already watching a podcast that's to do with breathing and health, and I work with clients one-on-one. So if you've been thinking about how can I take my health to the next level, it doesn't have to just be about the breath. It's about mindset, about physiology, about strength, about waking up in the morning when you just want to jump out of bed and get cracking. You don't need five coffees to get going. It's about not shouting at our kids. It's about being patient when we listen to our partners and being present. There are so many ways. The breath is the key to unlock. And so let me be the guide to help you do that. If you're interested in exploring how working with me could help enhance your life, then I've popped a link down below. Let's jump on Zoom. Let's have a complimentary conversation and let's see if this is something that is right for you. Here is Dr. Alan Watkins, and I look forward to meeting some of you again on Zoom soon. Cheers.
Well, I mean, there's lots and lots of stuff on the internet. I mean, you can read stuff, but I mean, to take it all with a pinch of salt, because, as I say, even, you know, cardiologists, you know, and I was a cardiologist, are not necessarily trained that well about HRV. I mean, I was when I went through COVID last year, I got a complication, which was pericarditis, which is an inflammation of the lining of the heart. And I went for an ECG, and I got talking to the cardiologist that had a look at me then. And he wasn't really clued up about HRV, and a lot of cardiologists aren't. So even, you know, in the cardiology, and it's a cardiological measure essentially, a lot of them are not clued up, mainly because you can't fix HRV. You can't improve HRV with a tablet or a bit of surgery. And of course, the medical model is, you know, tablets and surgery is the primary form of intervention. And now you can improve your HRV, just not with tablets and surgery. So a lot of the medical people are not that clued up themselves. So you've got to, you know, be a geek about this. And so you can read loads of stuff about this stuff on the internet, but you really need guidance. And so I've written about it in some of my books, particularly the Coherence book. And, you know, there's stuff on our app, the Complete app, all about heart rate variability, which will cut you to the chase and give you the stuff you really need to know. But like, you know, looking up anything medical on the internet, you can get either blinded by science or completely confused by erroneous information. So you've got to go to sources that are comprehensible and legitimate. Yes. And those are not necessarily the people who are trying to sell you a bit of kit.
And you might be reluctant to answer this, but if I've been putting off for this conversation, actually, because I really would like to get a sense of, well, I guess one of these 30, what is my HRV? I want to start doing a lot more things this year to improve it. I'm a dad now, and I'll, you know, live longer and be happier and less stressed and all these different things. So is it better to get a chest strap or a ring or a
chest
whoopee
strap
thing?
The Polar H7 and H10, very good. High quality. So again, to get a bit geeky about this, you know, when you and I are sat in a chair as we are now, our hearts are beating about 60 beats per minute. Mm-hmm. So if we were trying to, you know, when you've got the spike, the R wave, as it's called, the peak of your heartbeat, when your heart beats, you get a spike of electricity, it's called the R wave. You have to know exactly when that R wave occurs, and then when the next one occurs, to measure what's called the interbeat interval, the distance between each heartbeat. So you've got to accurately... Now, if you're only taking a picture of your heart rate once every second, the ability to accurately say where your heartbeat occurred wouldn't be very great. So you have to take minimum 256 pictures per second. So the sampling rate to get accuracy in your HRV is 256 hertz minimum. And a lot of kit doesn't do that. Now, of course, a really good kit would do it to the 1,000 hertz, you know, 1,000 samples a second. Then you can really precisely say when the heartbeat actually occurred. So some of these equipment manufacturers, you know, will sample, you know, almost every 3 seconds and give you an average. That's complete nonsense. But over time, these bits of kit are getting better. But you have to know which kit is, you know, capturing the data accurately enough to be able to measure it properly. But again, as I said, most equipment manufacturers just want to sell kit. They don't necessarily care that much about whether it's accurate or inaccurate, because they just say your number's 27 and they don't even give you the 27 watt. They're just giving you numbers and selling lots of kit with lots of marketing hype and money behind it and so on. But gradually, I've been watching this for 25 years, this entire field, and, you know, gradually the kit is beginning to get better. And I'd say we're probably half of all the kit out there is frankly rubbish, you know, and half of it's probably all right. Some of it, you know, is all right because we've assessed it in our lab. Other bits looks all right, but the equipment manufacturers won't tell you in their tech spec what they're actually doing, so you don't really know. But if you compare it to kit that you trust and it comes out with much the same reading, you can surmise that it's probably doing a decent job.
Wow.
You've got to be a geek about these things to know about, you know, which bits are... But the Polar H7, the Kaito ear clip is good from Japan, the Mio wrist strap, the Whoop, we think, is pretty good. But other things, I don't want to disparage in case somebody attacks me, but there's plenty of other bits of kit out there that is not good.
Interesting about the Whoop, because that's one I keep hearing a lot of people talk about Whoop. So I think you've answered my question. If I was going to get the chest strap, would you say you wear that all the time for like a week, or you do like one day a week? Because I'm just thinking, like, if you're testing it in the morning, I'm guessing that's different to night and bedtime. Would that be fair?
Well, it depends what you're trying to measure, right? I mean, you can do short-term measures, you know, 1 minute, 5 minute, 10 minute, you know, do that consistently, or you can wear it for a day, once a week. It depends what you're trying to measure. So for example, if you're wanting to discover what's happening with your adrenaline levels, right? So a big thing is readiness for training. So this, you see this in the sports market a lot. You know, should I train today and should I train intensively or not? And they're essentially measuring high and low frequency. So that, again, to get a bit geeky about it, there's time domain measures and frequency domain measures, the two main ways. So you're looking at how the heart rate varies over time over a 5-minute window, a 10-minute window, whatever, or you're looking at the speed of change. This is called frequency domain. And so frequency domain is probably more accurate than time domain measures. So frequency domain, if you look at low frequency changes, so changes in your heart rate over sort of 10 to 20 seconds, that's adrenaline. That's largely driven by adrenaline. And we know that because if you give anti-adrenaline drugs, the low frequency disappears. High frequency changes, so if we think of adrenaline as the accelerator of your system, the brakes, which is the opposite side, so not the sympathetic nervous system, which is the adrenaline, the parasympathetic nervous system, the brakes, that's high frequency changes. And so for me, it's pretty interesting. You think, well, you can tease apart the high frequency and the low frequency changes. So when your heart rate changes every 1 or 2 seconds, that's high frequency changes. When it changes every 10 to 20 seconds, that's low frequency changes. So the high frequency changes, that parasympathetic or acetylcholine is the chemical. The low frequency changes, that's sympathetic or adrenaline. So if you look at over a whole day and look for the low frequency changes, you can see what happens to people's adrenaline throughout the day. And generally speaking, adrenaline should be high when we're charging around at work, chatting to people. In the evening, it should be low. And at night, it should be very low. That's normal, right? Now, you'll see disruptions in those patterns. You know, so they don't follow the normal pattern, and that tells you things. But you can look at these, the balance between the high and the low, when people get very excited by the low frequency, high frequency ratio. And that's often what's used in these readiness. But again, people's thinking is way too binary about that, you know, because there's this sort of general view that if you've got really good parasympathetic tone, that's good. You know, and high sympathetic tone, that's bad. That's not true at all. Actually, you want both want to be high. It's a bit like your car. You want good brakes and good accelerator. So you want a high amount of power in your adrenaline and a high amount of power in your brakes. You want both of those. It's not a bind. It's not a, it certainly isn't a seesaw. I mean, I see a lot of people going, oh, high parasympathetic good, low sympathetic good. Yeah, it's a seesaw. It isn't a seesaw. You can see both sympathetic and parasympathetic go up. You can see both go down. You can see one go up, the other doesn't change, or vice versa. You can see all of these types of patterns. So you've got to have looked at this data a lot to understand what's really going on. And that's why, you know, the car metaphor in this regard works quite well. You can have powerful brakes, but, you know, your accelerator's shot, or your accelerator's average, or you can have a powerful accelerator and your brakes are shot, or your brakes are average. You know, I mean, you can see all these different variants and they all mean different things.
I love that analogy. Thank you. That's been that's really helped me understand that. And in a little bit, I'm going to dig a little bit more into the nervous system, actually.
Right.
I hear this term co-regulation. Can you explain what that means?
Co-regulation?
Yeah. Have you heard? Have you come across this?
So I
think it's my this is what I've heard around if I'm in a bad state or if I'm a young baby, my nervous system's all over the place and I need my parents to be nice and calm. Or I can do a certain breathing technique and that can influence other people in the room. Or is this a load of BS from what you've come across?
Right. Okay. Yes. So it's, well, let me just pull back a little bit. So imagine the variance in your heart rate. So basically, you know, the heart rate variability, it's like oscillating. You can think of the electricity of the heart as a sort of an oscillating kind of node, if you will. It's not just that the heart does this. There's lots of these nodes within one human being that oscillate. These are biological oscillators. And so there's a phenomena when you look at a system of biological oscillators called entrainment. And that's what you mean by co-regulation. We'll get on to co-regulation in a moment, right? But within one human being, you've got lots of biological oscillators. You've got collections of cells, neural networks that vibrate, if you will, or oscillate at a certain frequency, high frequency, low frequency, very low frequency, ultra low frequency, whatever, right? So you can think of them as pendulums. Now, the idea of entrainment was first described by Christian Huygens, you know, as of the Huygens telescope as a Dutch scientist in 1655. And the story goes that Huygens was ill in bed one day, and he was the inventor of the pendulum clock. So Huygens invented the pendulum clock, right? Which was a brilliant piece of technology, by the way, because up until Huygens invented the pendulum clock, you couldn't tell the time with precision of more than about 5 minutes. So all timepieces, you know, Mike, I'll meet you at noon, give or take 5 minutes. That was as accurate as anybody could get. He invented the pendulum clock. He got the accuracy down to 3 seconds. That was not better. That was 1655. That was not bettered until 1920.
Wow.
So imagine inventing a bit of kit that nobody improved on for 300 years. That's pretty clever.
Yeah.
Anyway, Huygens did that, right? And he noticed that he had a room for these pendulum clocks that he built, right? And he noticed that all of them were ticking in time. So tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. He thought, hang on a minute, all these pendulums are moving in sync. So he pushed a few of them out of sync, and they sort of were out of sync. But within about 15 minutes, they all tick-tock, tick-tock, tick-tock. They resynchronized. So he did this several times, and they just kept They just kept resynchronizing. So he described that as entrainment. Now, that is now a well-understood biological phenomena, and you see it in nature. So you'll see fireflies, for example, if you ever watch fireflies come out at night, they all start flashing, and then after a while, flash, flash, flash. You'll see it in shoals of fish, you know, so shark comes along, and all the fish move as one. Like, how are they doing that? Are they, quick, sharp, turn left? They're not talking to each other, but they all move as one. It's because they're entrained. They're all like oscillating nodes. And of course, most beautiful, the murmurings of starlings, if you've ever watched that at sunset, you know, this huge, you know, maybe 500,000 starlings or something, all flying and moving almost like a beautiful dance of cloud of starlings. Now, they're not operating collision avoidance like fighter pilots. They're all moving as one, and it's because they're all little biological oscillators, and they're radiating energy to each other, detecting that energy, and therefore you've got a wave front propagation going through a collection of oscillating systems. So that happens within one human body, right? Mm. So if you look at something like heart rate variability, and then you look at brain waves, and then you look at something called pulse transit time, which is the time it takes for the wave front of your blood pressure when your heart contracts to reach your fingertip, that's called pulse transit time. These oscillating systems can synchronize. So in one human system, when you breathe rhythmically, you drive entrainment. Mm-hmm. You drive a synchronization of your blood pressure with your breathing, with your HRV, and with your brain waves. These systems sync. So the inner experience is one of balance, because you literally are biologically balanced. And then it might draw your psychology. So your psychology starts to balance with your physiology. You start, wow, I feel super balanced, right? I mean, you go on meditation retreats, spend thousands of pounds to get this, but you can learn to do that in 5 minutes, right? So save yourself the money. So you can entrain your one system. Now imagine you and I are in the same room, right? And I start to entrain my system. Now the co-regulation you were talking about is, can I entrain Mike to me? And the answer to that question is yeah, right? Because if you see me as one pendulum oscillating and you as one pendulum oscillating, you know, and then we're just two pendulums in a system, we might synchronize, right? Now, again, that is not unusual. I mean, most women would understand this if they've lived in a house with five other women. Their menstrual cycles entrain. It's not like they're organizing that. You know, oh, by the way, next Tuesday, all right, for you, you know, well, yeah, and Tuesday, this just happens, right? I mean, it's a biological phenomenon. So this co-regulation happens in nature. You know, shoals of fish, flocks of birds, you know, women in the house, you know. So we can all entrain, and that's because we radiate biological information. So what a lot of people don't understand is your ECG doesn't stop at the skin. It radiates off the body. Mm. And because we radiate this biology, just like a pendulum clock radiates
across the wooden floor or through the air
and synchronizes another pendulum clock, you and I might synchronize. So therefore, the question arises, well, what's driving the synchronization? And it's usually the most powerful pendulum in a system of pendulums drives the entrainment.
Mm.
So in human terms, the most powerful radiator of coherent energy, effectively, will phase lock, it's called in mathematical, phase lock other pendulums in the room to the most powerful. So what we believe is happening is when you're in a negative emotional state, the energy that you're radiating is sort of discordant and erratic. But when you're in a positive emotional state, you radiate much more coherent energy, and it's much more powerful and phase locking others or co-regulating others to you.
That's so cool. Have you ever seen any studies or any examples of where, I don't know, somebody's gone in there? We're going to talk about coherence breathing in a second, but someone's in the room doing coherence breathing. They've got everybody, you know, all the hearts are connected. Have you come across anything like that where you've seen one person's breath work influence other people?
There's bits of like very early days on those types of research. There isn't any really great qualitative studies of size or scale with proper equipment that I've seen yet.
Mm.
I mean, I've seen that there are papers out there talking about this, but I think it's really early days, you know, because, of course, it's much loved amongst the New Age community, and there's a big bandwagon about that and, you know, massive extrapolation of what's really going on and all, you know, really overselling it. But proper, you know, really high quality, high definition science is still not there yet, as far as I've seen of that. But it'll happen, and partly because some really complex mathematics is you've got to first of all have the right kit, and as we discussed, a lot of the times people are using, you know, poor quality kit. You've got to have the right kit, and then imagine we did the experiment just between you and I, Mike, and we had good kit measuring me, good kit measuring you, and we, you know, time stamp your kit and my kit, so we could actually compare the outputs of your biology and my biology. Then we'd have to do some complicated mathematics. So if you started to become more coherent, would you be becoming coherent in phase with me? Yes or no? And then more complex maths to go, well, was it you driving me or me driving you? So this is quite complicated mathematics.
Mm.
And then to do that with 10 people, even more complex. But we're definitely moving in that direction. And I think within the next few years, we'll be doing studies like that, you know, with decent quality kit. And so what will be really fascinating is you'll be able to start to see who, energetically speaking, is the most powerful force driving the synchronization. Now, you can observe this phenomena in the world without all of this biological measuring. Like, I think when teams, like basketball teams, get into a state of flow, they're kind of phase-locking to each other, right? They're sort of sensing each other and synchronize with each other. And you'll see it occasionally with soccer teams, that it just flows. It, you know, you see a soccer team, you know, cut through like a hot knife through butter. It's just beautiful, the beautiful game, you know. It's just fantastic to watch. And in many ways, that complex system of a sports team is phase locked to each other, tuned into each other, and just responding almost at an intuitive or energetic level.
Mm.
So you can observe the phenomenon in the world, but the science hasn't yet quite caught up to really nail down the details and identify, well, who's causing the phase locking.
Very interesting. What's wonderful, and we'll talk about coherence now, is... you know, some of your videos are from, I think, 11 years ago. And it feels like coherence is very popular right now. There's lots of videos about it. And you've been talking about this for a good few years, which is beautiful. I just want to ask one last question. So when forgive me if I'm saying this wrong, when the heart syncs up with the brain and we see that sync happen, would that be considered flow state, or is that something completely different?
No, I think coherence is the biological basis of flow states.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so when you're phase locking, and remember, there's lots of oscillators. In a complex system, there are many, many oscillators, right? Mm-hmm. Just like in a company, lots of different people firing off at different levels. And, you know, that's why HRV, I think, is the primary energy generator. So if you look at the energy output
of the human heart, it's electrically 50 times greater than the brain.
So it's very interesting to me that, you know, science has grown up in this sort of cognitive-centric obsession with cognition and the brain and all the activity above the eyebrows, you know, and brainwave studies, you know, hundreds of thousands of EEG research studies. But you can't even see an EEG, a brainwave, if you don't pick up the heartbeat or the ECG off the earlobe and then mathematically remove it, because the ECG, the heart wave, is 50 times larger than the brainwave, the EEG. You can't see the EEG at all until you remove the ECG. Right, mathematically, you have to remove that, and then you see this tiny little brainwave. So what's driving, you know, the synchronization in the brain is the electrical signal from the heart. So 50 times more powerful than the brain electrically, electromagnetically, probably about 5,000 times more powerful. So that's why HRV and all of its sort of phenomena, related phenomena, is pretty interesting.
Mm.
Is it's probably in a single human being driving. So the flow state is probably when enough of your oscillators are synchronized. So, and one individual can be in flow, and then you can get a collection of individuals, like we're talking about in a sports team, can be in flow. Now, when I was at med school, you know, I used to row. Rowing was my sport. And of course, it's terribly interesting for lots of reasons, but mainly because it's probably the single sport that's most akin to synchronizing biological oscillators. I mean, that's the whole sport right there, is you're synchronizing. If you row in an eight, you know, eight guys in a boat, the whole thing is to synchronize so precisely the boat goes faster.
Mm.
Now, people who are slightly desynchronized, it's harder and it's more energy to drive the boat forward. So the more you synchronize, the more precisely you synchronize, the more power output and the more efficient it is, and the more the boat literally flows through the water. Mm-hmm. So I actually think the flow state, it's not all to do with endorphins and all this thing, and people bang or wax lyrical about, you know, alterations in perceptual awareness in the flow. So I think it's just coherence underneath it all. Mm. And we can talk about what's going on in your mind in flow states, you know, is it expanded or is it contracted consciousness or what, you know, what's happening. But in essence, I think coherence is the biological basis of the flow state.
Very cool. So let's jump into breathe in and breathe now, which I've been dying to get to, but I wanted to cover all that, which was so fascinating. Is this too simplistic to say the inhale is more stressful and the exhale is more relaxing? A bit like the inhale could be considered the accelerator and the exhale could be considered the brake. And if that is true or not true, why?
Yeah, not really true. So it's certainly, it's probably true to say that of the 12 parameters that you can learn to control as a human being, you can get conscious control of in your breath. I'll just run you through the 12 kind of different dimensions.
Mm.
As you've seen from my TED Talks, rhythmicity is probably the most important.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's different than depth of breathing. So I know... You know, a lot of people are very take a few deep breaths, but actually take a few rhythmic breaths is probably more helpful to your health and your performance than taking deep breaths. So rhythmicity is what it means in technical terms is a fixed ratio of in-breath to out-breath. What the ratio is a different thing entirely, but the fact that you fix it, you know, and so if you breathe 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out, i.e. you have a longer out-breath, that increases parasympathetic tone and makes you feel more relaxed. Mm-hmm. So that's why the mythology has grown up around, you know, breathing out is relaxing, breathing in is stressful. That's not really true. It's just that if you breathe out longer, you get an activation of the vagus nerve and an increase in parasympathetic tone. And again, I just want to pop the bubble of this obsession with relaxation. Because society, ever since Herb Benson wrote his book, The Relaxation Response, back in the 80s, you know, society has been obsessed with the idea of, you know, calm down, dear. to quote Michael Winner, or keep calm and carry on, you know, the sort of instructions during the war. You know, we've been obsessed with the idea that being calm is by definition helpful. That's not true. You know, so you know, but it's common parlance. Oh, did you have a nice relaxing weekend, Mike? Was your Christmas relaxing? Have you had a nice relaxing holiday? There's a sort of general view that relaxation is by definition good, and it's not. That's not true. I mean, I gave a lecture some years ago to the Institute of Psychiatry. Relaxation can kill you. So that put the cat amongst the pigeons, on the basis that if you're bored, you've got high parasympathetic tone, right? You're very relaxed. You just don't give a shit, right? That's not good. That is not good. So there are two types of arousal and there are two types of relaxation. So when you talk about the autonomic nervous system, arousal driven by the sympathetic nervous system and adrenaline, relaxation driven by the parasympathetic nerve and acetylcholine. But when you heat a system up, imagine you're going up vertically, you're heating the system up. You can go up and left or up and right. So if you go up and left, imagine there's a horizontal axis. On the left-hand side, there are the anabolic hormones, the build-up hormones. On the right-hand side, the catabolic hormones. So you can go up and left, so you get high levels of arousal with positive emotion and anabolic hormones. So things like passion, enthusiasm, and excitement, or you can go high, top right, where it's anger, frustration, and anxiety. Now, clearly you want top left, not top right. And likewise, when you cool the system down, you can go bottom left or bottom right. Now, if you go bottom left, lots of parasympathetic tone, and lots of DHEA, the molecule that makes testosterone and estrogen. So that will be contentment, serenity, equanimity, peacefulness, tranquility, so those types of states. But you can go bottom right, equally relaxed, heart rate's 55. That's boredom, apathy, inattentiveness, helplessness, hopelessness. That's not good for your health. You're relaxed, but you feel helpless. Mm. You feel powerless. That is not healthy because you've got surges of cortisol going through your system. And it's particularly pernicious because people think mistakenly that they're okay because they're relaxed. They're not. It's pernicious. They're going, oh, well, I don't care. I don't give a shit. Well, actually, you do. You're just kidding yourself, pretending like you don't. You're still in the bottom right. You've got lots of cortisol, the body's main stress hormone, and lots of parasympathetic tone. That is not good, right? And it's particularly not good because you think mistakenly that you're relaxed. And understanding that, the interplay between the autonomic nervous system on the vertical axis and the neuroendocrine or hormonal system on the horizontal axis, you know, it's really key. So that's the axis that we give people to make sense of all of this. And you want to live your life on the left-hand side with high levels of anabolic steroids, you know, DHEA and the other anabolic steroids, and avoid, you know, the right-hand side where you've got high tines of cortisol. In fact, the balance between cortisol and DHEA, probably the best biological marker of aging. So most of the modern diseases, whether it's senile dementia, cardiovascular disease, cancer, high blood pressure, diabetes, obesity, all of it underpinned by high levels of cortisol, low DHEA. So that's people who are living on the right-hand side of the universe, not the left-hand side of the universe. So we've got to get away from this binary, you know, high adrenaline bad, you know, high parathetic good. It's not, that is just not the case.
Gotcha. And from what you've seen, is there certain countries or demographics or industries that are better at living in the left versus the right? Who tends to be more naturally in the left that we don't need to intervene with as much versus... I feel like most of us are stuck in the right from what you're saying.
Yeah, yes. Sadly, yes. Yeah. Which is why most of us die premature, right? And we die from things that are largely preventable. Most of the diseases that kill human beings are largely preventable. But they get us. Why? Because we run high tides of cortisol. Why? Because, you know, we've never learned at school. And one of the, as you know, I've written 10 books and I'm writing book 11 and book 12. And book 11 at the moment is about the future of the educational system. And we were never taught to properly emotionally regulate at school. Nobody ever taught us this. So I end up spending quite a few hours of my day teaching this to 55-year-old CEOs because they weren't taught this when they were 8 years old at school. And so people's ability to regulate their own emotional state is pretty poor. And in fact, it's even worse than that. So we'll often, you know, get people in a room and go, okay, well, what emotional states do you even know? Yeah, make a list, right? Give you 5 minutes. Write down the emotions you've noticed in your system, in your life in the last week. Just make a list. Mm. And people go, oh, I want to make a list. I'm going to go anger, frustrated, irritation, annoyed, disappointed. Oh, shit, they're all negative. they look at their neighbour, they get an anger, I've got that. Frustration, I've got that one. Oh, shit, I better put positive. I felt okay on Tuesday. You know, so they write this. So you give them 5 minutes, give them 10 minutes. On average, people know about 12 emotions. I said, how many do you think there are? So, do you know, Mike? Do you know how many emotions there are?
I've just seen the TED Talks. So I don't want to give the game away.
Well, there are 34,000.
Yeah.
Right,
I would have guessed about 500 max. No, probably 300 within my guess. Yeah,
yeah. Well, yeah. If you go on that app has currently got 2,000 for you to play, and I'm about to load up another 1,500.
Wow.
So soon it will have 3,500 emotions for you to explore in the universe of emotions, as we call it. So most people's literacy is really important. I mean, we are literally human beings are illiterate emotionally.
Mm.
So you know, I mean, you can do this experiment. So you know, bump into somebody tomorrow and go, you know, how are you? How'd you feel? Go, all right. I feel all right, okay? So try this. Do you feel all right or do you feel not bad? Or do you feel okay or do you feel so-so? Do you even know the difference between all right, not bad, okay, and so-so? Mm. Most people go, what are you talking about?
Yep.
The literacy is appalling. So they've got, you know, clumps. They've got like 12 emotions of which 34,000 planets are clumped into one of these 12. So our literacy is literally appalling. And it's because we weren't taught at school. This wasn't even a conversation at school, which is why one of the reasons I think we've got so much mental health problems today is we were never taught the skills we really needed to navigate successfully in life. And therefore, a lot of people find when life is challenging, they can't deal with the emotions that come with that challenge. They're easily overwhelmed. Why? Because nobody ever taught them how to regulate their emotions in response to moments of difficulty, like we all go through in our lives.
Mm.
You know, and therefore, the anxiety's got me. I haven't got it. It's got me. I am the subject of this anger. It's got me.
Yeah.
Right? It's called a subjective experience. I am the subject. So I've never learned sovereignty. I've never developed my own ability. So if I said to you, okay, how do you feel right now? And you said, I feel okay. Okay, Mike, I want you to move from the planet of okay to the planet of exuberant, and I want you to do that right now. Now, most people can't do that consciously, simply because nobody's ever taught them how to. But if you do develop those capabilities, your life changes dramatically because you then got the ability to change how you feel on demand. Now, the good news is we do it accidentally. You know, your favorite piece of music comes on the radio and you feel uplifted, right? You know, the grey clouds that we get in Britain, suddenly they break and the blue sky comes through and the sun comes out and we feel fantastic. So we do change how we feel all the time. We just don't do it on purpose. And so that's a large thing that we teach people is, well, how do you do it on purpose?
Mm.
So once you learn to do this under your own conscious control, your life completely changes. Because you're no longer the victim of the weather, you know, your husband, your wife, your kids, your boss, the government, somebody else who you believe mistakenly is causing you to feel bad. Is you can't blame somebody. When you've got sovereignty, you determine that.
Yeah.
And that will change your life.
That's incredible. I heard once about, on the podcast, somebody talking about... I think it was a guy called Ram Dass, who's like a kind of a guru-esque person that went to India in the 70s,
yeah, yeah.
American guy. And he said, I think it was Duncan Trussell on Duncan Trussell podcast, and he said something like, he's the only guy that I think you just couldn't offend. He just had complete control over all his emotions, let's say. I'm paraphrasing wrong. Would you say that would it be hard to offend you? Would you feel like you have that?
Oh, yeah, it's very hard to offend you.
Yeah.
My wife can get through.
Of course, yeah.
She's quite... because the guards now do.
Sure.
Yeah. But yeah, generally speaking, it's quite difficult to irritate me, largely because I control my emotions. So I haven't given the power away. But sadly, most people have given the power away. They run a program, you know, like, you upset me, Mike. You did it to me. So it's your fault. Because I'm seeking to blame you for how I feel, right? So you did. And that feels legitimate because I'm off the hook now because I've blamed Mike for my annoyance. But as I teach people, nobody, you know, Mike didn't inject me with anger. Like, he hasn't slipped me tablets that's created the chemistry of anger. I've done that to myself in response to somebody else's back. So the newsflash is nobody's doing anything to anybody, right? Mm-hmm. We're doing all of this to ourselves. We are the architect of all of our own emotions, good and bad. Now, that one simple fact will change your life if you understand it properly. If you believe somebody else is doing it to you, then you naturally will assume that it's up to them to make you feel better. Come on, Mike, make me feel better because it was you that annoyed me. Make me feel better. Of course, you don't. So I just stay annoyed. But when I switch that, I go, well, it Mike may have behaved bad or well, doesn't matter, but the chemistry of anger or delight was created by me. So if I'm the architect of my own emotions, I can change them at will. If I think somebody else is causing them to be present, then I can't change them. So this Ramdas that you're talking about has just learnt, and he's not the only person in the world, but I'll tell you a story in a moment. You can learn to self-regulate where it would be almost impossible for other people to upset you. So I'll often say to people, if you want to piss me off, you're going to need my permission. Because I'm going to decide whether I get pissed off or not, not you. And so imagine that. Imagine you can go through your life only feeling the emotions you really want to feel. I go, what? Hang on a minute. Are you saying I don't have to feel anxious? I go, no, not if you don't want it. What? I never have to feel anxious again. No, you don't have to feel anxious again. Whatever. Not if you don't want to. Is that legal? That's like, people think it's the law that I've got to feel bad about myself or I've got to feel anxious. And, you know, this is how lost people are. And in fact, sadly, many people get stuck on those negative planets, particularly in the bottom right, for such a long time, they start to identify with those planets. You'll hear people say, I am anxious. They go, no, no, that's not who you are. You're not just a single emotion. I mean, who you are is a beautiful, complicated thing. You're not just a single emotion. I am depressed. No, you're not. You're just stuck on the planet of depression. Now, we'll have to do some stuff to get you off the planet, but that doesn't define who you are. But some people have literally been stuck now on those negative planets, but again, the bottom right-hand quadrant. And so it takes quite a bit of effort to get them off the planet, but we're not any one of these things. Mm. We're not delighted either. You know, I am delighted. No, I'm experienced delight. I feel delighted. It's not who I am. Mm. Who I am is a much more complicated answer, but... So we're trying to help people really understand all this emotion stuff because it's what drives us forward as human beings. It's a really interesting agenda. It's by the way, it's what gives meaning to our life. I mean, if you climbed Mount Everest, Mike, and you didn't feel, you know, exuberant at the top of Mount Everest, what would be the point? You know, if it was just like, you know, meh, as we say, M-E-H, that's one of the planets, meh. You know, at the top of Mount Everest. I mean, what would be the point of climbing Mount Everest if you got to the top and you felt meh? So actually, emotions are what gives our life meaning. It's what imbues all of our relationships, you know, fulfillment, happiness, contentment, some of the things that we say we're after. So the guy that you're talking about has just learned to live his life on the left-hand side and control his emotions. They did, of course, if you want to really understand how this really works, you go and study the world champions of all of this are the Tibetans. So the Tibetans are a very interesting nationality because they've really built nothing. You know, I mean, they haven't invented Apple or, you know, any big tech company that had Tibet. There aren't any. You know, I mean, the height of Tibetan sophistication is yak butter. That's what the yak butter, that's it. That's their big technology. Yak butter. Oh, well done. But what they are world champions at is this inner journey, this mastery of self. You know, so up on the Tibetan plateau, they've looked inwards. And so it's an estimate of theirs that there are 34,000 different emotions it's possible to experience. That's based on talking to the world champions of emotional mastery, which are the Tibetans. And so a lot of this insight comes from working with them. So that the Dalai Lama and his team meet with the neuroscientists about every 3 or 4 years. Matthew Rickard, who's the Dalai Lama's right-hand man, who I know reasonably well, he's the sort of go-between between the contemplative sciences, as you call it, and the neurosciences. And so they meet and swap data. And so some of these neuroscientists, like Richie Davison, has studied these guys in detail, like what's going on in their brain. You know, I've measured Matthew and some of his colleagues' HRV. That was really interesting. We did that study a few years back, looking at what was happening in their HRV in different states of meditation. We can come back to that if you like. So you go and study these people and find out what they're really doing. And it's really they're training themselves to get, you know, emotional regulation to a high degree. Now, the good news is anybody can learn to do this. It's just the guy you're talking about has probably done it better than most. But, it, you know, it's not, there's nothing unique about that person. I mean, I'd say I was pretty good at regulating my own emotions, and maybe not, you know, the world champion, but I'm, you know, probably, you know, Olympic standard type stuff. But anybody, and anybody, Joe Public, anybody in the street. In fact, if you go on our app, you can learn how to do this. We teach you how to do this with the various missions that you can follow. You can train yourself to do this, and it will change your life for the better once you do do regulate your own emotions. So you don't really have to feel anxious unless you really want to. You don't really have to feel bad and guilty and all those things, which, not that there's anything per se wrong. Where it becomes difficult, Mike, is if you get stuck. So you might, like, sadly, my wife and I, we lost all four of our parents during COVID, none of them from COVID. But you don't have to get stuck in grief and, you know, low mood. So, you know, feeling grief is not bad. Feeling sad is not bad, right? It only becomes bad if you get stuck there for years. It's stuck on that planet. That's when these negative states, because then you're just pumping out cortisol all the time, that's causing health problems and so on. So you might feel low, but if you've got the skills, you get off those planets relatively quickly. And then I look back with appreciation for who my parents were and who her parents were, you know, and can see them, and they can become a positive force in my life, even though they're no longer here. So you just live your life on the left-hand side. It's much healthier, it's more enjoyable, it's more fun, it's more entertaining than living your life on the right-hand side. But sadly, most human beings have never been taught these skills, do live their life on the right-hand side of the universe.
I'm reminded of this kind of stimulus and response. If I can just go here with you for a second. So example one is I'm cut off in traffic and it's ruined my day. And all day long, I'm just talking about it. You know, this silly driver, blah, blah, blah. No idea what was up with them. Number two is somebody does something that really hurts my family. In both cases, I'm going to feel a version of anger. I'm sure there's many versions as you talk about. Now, is it that in both cases, it's okay to feel anger, but I need to move through it? Or if we become so good with emotional regulation, I wouldn't actually feel anger? Or is the point not to get rid of the anger, it's to feel it and move through it? Can you just explain a bit more about that?
Yeah, feel it and move through it is more anger. So even the Dalai Lama gets angry, he just doesn't stay angry for very long. He identifies it super fast and moves off it. So think of it this way. It's a sort of shorthand to say positive and negative emotions. What we really mean is the negative ones aren't really negative. They're just energy. Energy in motion, emotion, right? But if you stay there for too long, they become negative. That's the point, right? The Dalai Lama gets angry, suddenly goes, okay, what's anger? What's the message? So as Alan Watts, who's, you know, one of my heroes, wrote, you know, did some of the translations of the Tibetan and the Buddhist work originally. He has this lovely story about, you know, pick up the phone. Once you've received the message, put the phone down. Right? Don't keep on the line. No, I got the message. Anger, and anger is a natural response. So it's not wrong per se. It's just if you get stuck there, it's unhelpful. So I'm in a state of anger. I move away from it. I'm not trying to get rid of it. I'm just, you know, it's still going to be there. It's still a planet in the universe. I'm just not living there. I'm going to move off that planet to something more constructive. So if you use the Dalai Lama, he will feel momentary anger. He'll pick up the phone. He'll receive the message. Anger is telling you there's something wrong. You know, the Chinese have, you know, culturally misappropriated Tibetan society. That's not good. I feel angry about that. Right, I'm going to move from the planet of anger to the planet of determined. And from the planet of determined, I'm going to go out in the world and tell a story about Tibet. And he's disseminated his teachings much more widely than if the Chinese hadn't invaded and misappropriated his entire country. So he's done something useful from the planet of determination, which probably would never have even occurred to him if he'd have stayed on the planet of anger. So it's more that second version, like you move away from that planet, you experience it, you get the message, you hang up the phone, to use Alan Watts's expression, and you move to something that's more useful and more constructive, and you become more of a positive influence in the world. So it's a bit more like that, I think.
Now, are you using your thinking mind to take you through these different emotions, or are we using the actual body itself? Because there's a breathing technique called vivation. I don't know if you've ever come across this. It's the second known breathing technique, not known, registered Western breathing technique, obviously the millennia old. And this one's all about a feeling-led practice. So we don't want to spend too much time in the mind. We just want to feel. And sometimes the feeling might be my bum touching the seat or my feet touching the floor, or I might have some sadness near my heart or some sadness in my eyes or some joy here or some pain in my shoulder. And so we spend our time focusing on these different emotions. And they talk a lot in this. This comes from India. They talk about we suppress some things,
yeah,
and we can integrate some of these feelings, yeah, emotions. And suppression takes a lot of energy. And if we can integrate it and be okay with it, we can move through it. So, how does that line align with any of the bits that you're talking about? Yeah. Is there anything there?
So let's build it up from the bottom up, right? So we make a distinction, which Antonio Damasio, one of the greatest neuroscientists of recent years, got me thinking about this, because when I read this book, he hadn't quite made this distinction. I mean, it's now more widely understood that emotions and feelings are not the same thing. So emotions are just the energy in motion, emotion. Feelings are the conceptual awareness of that energy. So the metaphor I use to get this across to people is, imagine your body is the orchestra, right? Your heart, clearly the string section. Your gut, clearly the wind section, right? And your HRV, the lead violin within the string section. So the pressure waves of blood pressure might be the cello, and so on. So every second of every day, we all have emotions, even men, right? Because our body's constantly playing a tune. The heart's constantly beating. We're constantly breathing in and out. The gut's constantly digesting. So there is electrical, electromagnetic, chemical pressure waves, heat waves, sound waves, light waves from every single bodily system. That's what an emotion is. It's all about energy, the emotion, emotion. That's not the same thing as a feeling. A feeling is the awareness of which tune. Is our body playing Beethoven or is it playing Pearl Jam? Like, can we tell? Now, if we can't tell, we're basically illiterate. We can't distinguish Beethoven from Pearl Jam. And so this sort of tuning into the body, that is a cognitive process, right? So so cognition, conceptual awareness, so a feeling is a sort of halfway house between the energy, the emotion, and pure cognition, absent emotion, right? So it's sort of, that's why it's a critical thing in a human system. A feeling is the conscious awareness of all the biological signals, and it might be a tension in this shoulder or a twisting of the spine or a sort of gurgling of the gut or whatever. So this ability to be aware of our biology is called interoception. You know, and there's good degrees of that. People who are like overly attuned to it then might become neurotic. Oh my God, I can feel my heart. You know, they're overly attuned to it. But, you know, most people are completely dead to it. You know, or they repress them. And men, classic strategy, we're so scared of the word emotion and feelings,
you know, we throw the baby out with the bathwater. We deny that we've got such things, which is nonsense, of course. So,
but if you tune into it, learn to understand this data, because it's just data. It's biological data. Emotions are just composite biological signals. You know, all that energy from all those biological systems that then we learn to understand and we label as anger versus frustration, because the biological signal is slightly different in those two states. Mm-hmm. So if you tune in, right, the feeling is the bridge between emotion and cognition, if you will. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Thank you. I love that. Yeah. Interception. Yeah, I've heard this term before. Does interception help with heart rate variability if we spend more time
focusing? So if you, it certainly does. So you're tuning into, so the first thing, this is where breathing comes back in, is if we want to get our HRV under control, the first thing is breathe, right? So how you control the lead violin is through rhythmic breathing. And so this is a very interesting thing. Many years ago, there's a brilliant physician called David Servan-Schreiber. The Servan-Schreibers are like the Heseltines in France. They own the Psychology magazine, for example. That they're quite a famous political family. I think one of them was the foreign minister of France some years back. Anyway, David was a brilliant psychiatrist based out of Pittsburgh. And he wrote this. In fact, when I set the business up, when I left medicine 25 years ago and set up the business, David was going to run the French arm of our business. And then he wrote this book called Healing Without Freud or Prozac. And he has a whole chapter on cardiac coherence, basically what I taught him. Most of it correct, some of it not. And he wrote this book, and it became a bestseller. And he did this show once with Matthew Ricard on stage in Paris. Matthew was like well known for being able to radiate loving kindness. And he was showing the HRV signal, and it was all over the place. And that's because Matthew had got the orchestra playing a good tune, but the lead violin was playing off key because he hadn't got his breathing sorted out. He wasn't breathing rhythmically. So how you start to control the HRV or the lead violin is through rhythmic breathing. But you've got to be very clear, the lead violin is not the orchestra and the orchestra is not the lead violin, as David rather embarrassingly discovered that evening. So once you've got rhythmic breathing and you've got a coherent signal, that's not game over. So this whole journey is not just about rhythmic breathing. It's about getting the whole orchestra in train, and the whole orchestra, not just the electrical signal of the heart as represented by heart rate variability, but, you know, all the other biological signals in sync. I'm controlling the entire orchestra, the entire emotional set, not just one signal within that set. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. Thank you. I'd love to ask your thoughts on the 4-6 breathing versus an equal breath. So my understanding always was like a nice equal breath. And again, this is where we butcher science and we say it balances the nervous system because it's a balanced breath. And I'm sure you can tell me why that's wrong in a second. But what data output are you seeing from a 4-6 breath that you think would be better than an equal breath? Is it the heart rate variability is more?
Let's compare two, you know, very similar. 4-6 versus 5-5. Because both of them are a 10-second cycle. So in most, there's something called a resonant frequency. And that's literally a 10-second cycle for most people is the optimum. So most people with an average-sized lung, a 10-second cycle, which means, you know, breathing in and breathing out is a 10-second cycle. So that can be delivered by 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out. It's a 10-second cycle, right? Or 4 seconds in, 6 seconds out. It's a 10-second cycle. So a 10-second cycle gives you this sort of 0.1 hertz on your frequency spectrum of your HRV. Now, that's very close to the resonant frequency of the human system for most average-sized people, which means the sort of signal between the heart and the brain is at its peak and its optimum in a 10-second cycle, which is why a lot of people are very interested. Now, people of different shapes and sizes, some people, you know, a 12-second cycle might be their resonant frequency, other people an 8-second cycle, but let's just take a 10-second cycle just for the sake of argument here. Now, is 4-6 better than 5-5? Well, probably slightly better because the elongated out-breath gives you a little bit more parasympathetic tone, a little bit more relaxation. And given that most people are a little bit agitated, so just bringing it down a tad is probably more useful than, you know, sort of hyper-vigilant sort of state that most people are in. So if you did a head-to-head competition of 5-5 versus 4-6, not a massive difference, but given most people are slightly wound up, 4-6 probably would slightly shade it compared to 5-5. But what's more important than either of those things, because that's really the pattern, right? I said there are 12 things that you can control it, but pattern is number 5. Mm. Number one, rhythm, which is you fix it, either 5-5 or 4-6. Just fix the ratio, right? Don't dance around. Just pick a ratio and fix it. Mm-hmm. Once you've got a fixed ratio, then it's a smoothness within that ratio. Because you can breathe rhythmically, but staccato. So if you go, and that's rhythmic, but it's staccato. What you really want is silky smooth rather than the entire envelope. So that's the number two, right? So breathe rhythmically and even. So fixed volume per second in technical terms. And by the way, that's just what you do when you teach a rowing crew, a novice rowing crew. You put the blades in the water, you take the blades out of the water. Rhythm, in, out. That's what the cock shouts. In, out, in, out. So you get the rhythm going. Now, once you've got the rhythm going, I imagine those blades go in the water, you've got to apply pressure equally throughout the stroke. If you put the blades in the water, pull really hard and then let them drift, and then pull hard and let them drift, you know, the boat's going to wobble a lot, right? But you put them in the water and you sweep. So when I coach the GB rowing squad, you know, they talk about these people, they sweep the water. Mm. It's called sweeping, literally. They sweep the water in a nice, smooth, even pattern. So rhythmicity, number one. Smoothness, number two. Location of attention, number three, in the heart area. Speed of breathing, number four. Pattern, whether 4-6 or 5-5. Number five, volume, you know, how much air in one single breath, is number six. Synchronization, number seven. Depth, number eight. There's a few others, right? So there's all these different things you can learn to control in your breathing, but what changes your consciousness and your awareness and your perceptiveness and therefore, you know, your success in anything in life, the smarter you are, the clearer thinker you are, the more progress and more success you'll have, is the smoothness, the rhythmicity, and imagine you're breathing, not through the belly, not belly breathing, a lot of people teach, no, breathe through the heart, because this is where you start to tap into positive emotions.
On this logic of, I'm fascinated by the different ways we can breathe. So we've got like a 4-6. What about a 2-8 or 1-9? Or would we be going too far in the direction that would cause a different problem?
No, I mean, we're relatively relaxed. So on our app, you can train yourself, and there's a breath pacer where you can try all these different variations and see which one suits you the most. So one of our beta test community likes to breathe at 3 breaths per minute, like really slow, right? And he's found that that really does it for him. So fine, right? So do that. If that's really, you know, flowing your bones and it makes you more effective, great, whatever. So everybody's physiology is slightly different, but as a general rule, you know, people have over-egged certain ratios and they imbue them, right? So again, the pattern is number 5 of 12 on the list of priorities. So people will bang on about, oh, it's, you know, because it's not just the in and the out, it's the hold at the top and the hold at the bottom. So they'll get even more granular and go, like, it's not 8-2, it's 1-7, 1-1, or whatever it is, right? And they'll give you the whole thing. And then they imbue it with sort of mystical powers, these certain patterns. And they'll forget the rhythmicity is more important and smoothness within that rhythm is more important than the actual ratio. Ratio is number 5. So I always say, look, make sure whatever pattern you choose, that it's rhythmic and it's smooth and it's through the heart. And then whatever ratio works for you in terms of the size of your lungs. I mean, people have got different sized lungs, and your resonant frequency will be slightly differently. So
watch your data, but base it on watching your data from a kit that actually measures it properly, and you'll figure out what is optimum for you. So we're not the breath police. We're just saying, actually, base it on proper science, but don't learn to juggle before you've learned to walk. Walking's probably more useful as a human being than juggling. So why are you learning to juggle before you've even learned to walk? So go to rhythm, go to smoothness, go to location, go to speed, then go to pattern.
Love it. You said on another podcast a little while ago, something along the lines of this coherence breathing can reduce the age-related decline of your heart. Can you tell me by how much and why?
So generally speaking, when you're measuring HRV, you're measuring two types of things. Most of the literature is concerned with the quant, I mean, how much variability you've got, because that's what predicts mortality. And if you've got very little variability, you're in trouble. And if you've got lots of variability, that's generally speaking, as long as it doesn't become excessive, good. Okay, so as a general broad brushstroke. So then, in addition to the amount, coherence is really about the pattern. It's not to do with the amount, it's to do with the pattern of your variability. So think of it of how much petrol you've got in your tank. Is your tank full or are you going on fumes? You're going on fumes, you've got very little variability, but is it two-stroke petrol or is it rocket fuel? That's sort of like the quality of the energy, if you like. Is it coherent or is it chaotic? So they're largely independent variables. So if you think of them as separate things, you can increase the amount. So I've got a lot of petrol in the tank, but it's all two-stroke. What you really want is a lot of petrol in the tank is all rocket fuel. So you want high amounts of coherence. High amounts of HRV, and it all be coherent. So the two things are not completely independent. So the best way of explaining this is imagine you're driving a car and you're driving the car in London traffic, stop, start, stop, start, stop, start, stop, start. And you'll see your HRV surging and stopping, surging and stopping. So you'll create a chaotic signal, essentially. Or you're driving down the freeway and you're kind of cruising, in relatively heavy traffic between 40 and 60 miles per hour. So there's sort of a surge and then a slowing and a surge and a slowing. So more like a sine wave, so you'll get more coherent. Now, if you're stop, start, stop, start, stop, start with a chaotic signal, you'll get about 20 to the gallon. But if you're doing these surges down the freeway, you'll get about 40 to the gallon. So if you're running a coherent pattern, the decay over time is less. So coherence leads to a reduced biological decay, if you will. In fact, what we've seen when we've coached individuals is if they start to train themselves to become more coherent more of the time, is they can actually reverse the age-related decline. So roughly, if you look at the literature, there's about a 1 to 3% per annum decline in the amount of HRV through our lifetime. So you've got this much when you're 25, and then over time it gets less and less and less. So you get to 75, 80, there's no HRV, and bye-bye, go. So you can reverse that. So we've seen about a 25% reversal in 6 months when people practice coherent breathing and the emotional regulation skills, is you can reverse the age-related decline. So we'll often sort of say to clients, it's kind of like getting the energy back you had 10 years ago. So you get a 25% reversal, and you can feel that. You feel much more energetic. You feel the quads, so not only the amount, but also the quality of your energy is better. So you're gliding through, it's less, it's more graceful, more flowing, flow state, if you like. The quantity and the quality are not entirely independent. That makes sense?
It does. And is there anything going on with the diaphragm here? Because I've read a couple of things around, our diaphragms tend to get locked. We don't use them as much. I think Dr. Chatterjee talks about we're using it about a centimetre, but we could use 10 centimetres. And when we engage the diaphragm more, maybe doing a coherence breathing, and we are breathing rhythmically and probably a bit deeper with the diaphragm, we take some pressure off the heart. Have you got anything around any of that?
Well, I mean, we all breathe with our diaphragm. I mean, that is the main respiratory muscle, right? If it's not the diaphragm, which muscles are doing it, right? Well, there's a little bit of help comes from the intercostal muscles, right? This is where deep breathing becomes interesting, because the definition of a deep breath is where you take the air, if I can stand up, to the lower ribs here. So if you take a deep breath, what you're really doing is flaring the lower ribs. So you're basically taking the air all the way down into the lungs, into the lower ribs. Now, of course, when people say take a deep breath, most of the time they mean a large volume.
Mm.
So they say deep, but they actually mean big. So because they're confused, right? They don't understand these things are different. So, but a deep breath could be 200 mils, right? It's not big volume breath, but you're taking it all the way down and you're just flaring the lower ribs, which is largely using the intercostal muscles of the lower ribs, right? If you see somebody with, I used to run the respiratory clinic at Southampton Hospital, and people with lung disease, and they will use the accessory muscles up here to try and help, because either their diaphragm's shot or their intercostals are shot. They'll do that. You'll see that, you know, that these muscles up here being sort of, you know, tapped into to try and cheat. But nearly all breathing is diaphragmatic, right? Even in people who are breathing well or badly, it's nearly all driven by the diaphragm with a little bit of help from the intercostals. Mm. Usually not much from the accessory muscles unless you've got lung disease. So with that in mind, of course, you can strengthen. This is what opera singers do to hold a note, right? You know, you'll hear, you know, the guy that sings, I can't remember his name, you know, Lovely Day, if you remember that song, you know, A Lovely Day. And he just goes and goes and goes. Of course, every time you hear that, you try and hold it with him. And it, you know, and it's just that he's trained his diaphragm, and you'll see opera singers the same. So you can, it's like any other muscle, you can train it to be stronger.
Mm.
But most people haven't physically trained it. So there's probably some value in that, but not at the expense of rhythmicity, smoothness, location of attention, right? So what you'll see in any field of scientific medicine, people grab onto a piece of the story and embellish that piece as the main piece because they've necessarily understood the whole system. So people will constantly clutch at a piece and have a true answer, but it's a partial answer and it sometimes ignores the whole.
Gotcha. Final question for you. That was really helpful, by the way. Thank you. If people want to start practicing coherence breathing off the back of this, what's the minimum effective dose? How often? How much? All that sort of stuff.
Well, to be honest, 1 minute more than you did yesterday. Right? I mean, it's a ratio gain. Most people are breathing erratically most of the time, but they don't have the awareness because they're not paying. What are we paying attention to? Our email, our spreadsheets, and all the stuff out there. We're not paying attention to ourselves. So if you just breathe rhythmically 1 minute today and you had no minutes yesterday, you're moving forward. And, you know, so if you just build up those ratios, and the best time to do that is when you're traveling, when there's not much going on, you're on the underground or you're on a train, you know, or you're a passenger in the car, do it then. Or if you're sat in the, on the couch at home, you know, just a few minutes or just a lunchtime, or early in the morning, maybe 2 or 3 minutes before you get out of bed, just a bit of rhythmic breathing before you start the day. And once you start doing this, if you can start paying attention to your breathing and start noticing, actually, when I'm performing well, am I breathing a bit more rhythmically? When I'm performing badly, it's usually because my breathing is a bit more erratic. So if you start to notice that, you actually go, oh, hang on a minute, I can start to see a pattern. My better performance is when I've got my breathing under control. And, you know, because most negative emotional states involve erratic breathing. So if you look at somebody who's anxious, they're breathing rapid, erratic, and shallow. So, Yeah, well, what are you breathing like that for? Oh, I didn't know I was. Or if you looked at somebody who's frustrated, what they're doing is they're holding their breath. You know, they're frustrated, right? Because they're holding, you're just breathing badly. So if you start to just get the discipline, just a couple of minutes, and you start instilling some coherent breathing, some rhythmic, even breathing, you'll find the anxiety and the frustration melts away. Because in order to experience anxiety and frustration, you've got to breathe badly. So if you just, it's like taking, just remove that CD and install a different CD in your stack and start breathing rhythmically and smoothly, coherently, right? You find the anxiety. So I defy anybody to hold on to a state of frustration whilst breathing rhythmically and evenly. It's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Right?
Beautiful.
So if you just start to do that, you start to notice that actually better quality breathing improves your performance as a human being. It improves your perceptual awareness. You start to notice your brain starts to work better. You come up with better answers to the problems you're facing. So, you know, start with a minute every day, just build it up, start to wonder about that, become curious, start to explore, because you can transform your capability way more than you realize with a bit of precise guidance. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how much better we can become as human beings with a little bit of practice. It doesn't require much, just a few minutes a day.
Yeah.
It's not even as bad as going to the gym. You know, 20 minutes in the car and blah, blah, blah. You know, just a couple of minutes on the couch.
Yeah.
Or even if you're just in a meeting, just noticing what's happening, either in your breathing or the breathing of people around you. It's quite interesting to watch it on people being interviewed on television. You know, you see their breathing, you see their chest going up and down in a sort of erratic fashion, and they're talking nonsense, of course, and then people who are giving better quality answers, you'll often see their breathing is much more even. So I just encourage people to just experiment with it. 1 minute a day is better than no minutes a day. 3 minutes is better than 1 minute. 5 minutes is better than... And after a while, once you've sort of practiced a bit, eventually it becomes your default. So if I plug myself to any biofeedback kit now, I have to work quite hard to get disordered breathing going in my system. You know, because coherent breathing is the default. Yeah. I mean, I just do that as a natural because I've just practiced so much. It just sits there most of the time.
Fascinating. This has been a true masterclass. Thank you so much for this. I've enjoyed it so much. I know everyone that watch and listen is going to love this as well. I feel like I really got to geek out. You've made everything very accessible. So thank you for doing that.
My pleasure, yeah.
We're going to link to everything down below. So anybody watching and listens to this can find your app, can go to your website. I'm going to link to your TED Talks as well. Just wanted to really ask you, are there any final words to close us off?
Well, you know, be fascinated with this, the human system. And I spent, I calculated recently, 110,000 hours studying the human system, right? And just to put that in context, when I was at med school, I was at med school for 10,000 hours. That's 6 years of med school, that's 10,000 hours. When you're at school, from the age of 5 to the age of 16, that's 14,000 hours. But then 110,000 hours, right? So, because I'm just absolutely fascinated with what makes us, you know, have a fantastic time or have a terrible time. And just, I'm super optimistic because what I've discovered essentially is there's a ton of things that you can do. Pretty simple, pretty straightforward things to make your life more enjoyable, more successful, starting with just a few minutes. That's all it takes. So, you know, you matter more than you think and you can do a lot better than you realize. It doesn't take that much.
Thank you. You're an important voice in this space and I appreciate everything you're doing. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. Lovely talking to you.
Thank you for watching, everyone. Lovely talking to you too. I told you, didn't I? Wow, Dr. Alan Watkins, so much information. I'm going to have to go back and watch that podcast at least 3 or 4 times to get all the juicy breath, coherence, HRV goodness out of it. Thank you for sticking all the way through to the end. I'm so grateful you give me your time and attention. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please click that button. It really helps us. I can't explain how much it helps us. And I'll continue bringing you these sorts of conversations. And I just want to touch upon again, if you've been thinking about, oh, I don't know if this coaching's for me, then come and jump on a call with me. I offer bespoke coaching. I only take on a number of clients, very limited number, and I build programs for you. Where's your breathing right now? Where are you trying to get to in life? Forget the breathing. Is it to stop shouting at the kids? Is it to have more focus, more concentration, to be fitter in the gym, to be better in the bedroom? Whatever your goals are, let's have a conversation. And we can see if there's a way to build a plan for you. Now, as always, we finish off these podcasts with a breathing exercise. And it would be rude of me not to do a coherence breathing. So here is a lovely coherence breathing track. Enjoy. Breathe softly on the in. Breathe gently on the out. You don't need to fill up or empty. Just take your time. Enjoy it. Practice it daily if you can. And I will see you soon. Thank you so much. Bye. Slowly, gently in through the nose, and slowly, gently letting go. Softly in through the nose. And softly out. Smoothly in through your nose. And gently out through your nose. Softly in. Softly out. Slowly, gently in through the nose. And slowly, gently letting go. that's it, you're done. You're exactly where you need to be. So just be really kind with yourself now. Take a few moments to wiggle those fingers and toes as you bring yourself back into the day-to-day. If you've enjoyed this exercise, why not subscribe or share with a friend or a loved one? And if you're interested in taking your breath work to the next level, you can contact Mike Mayer directly and inquire about his one-on-one coaching packages. We'll see you soon. Breathe well, my friend.